I think that if you identify with Gaia as opposed to identifying with an individual species, then there is a sense in which we do have a kind of immortality. You know, as Carl Sagan said, Earth is where we make our stand. But I think that's true about we as contemporary humans. But as, you know, as agents of the biosphere in the long run, I do think that we're going to be around for a long time, maybe even sort of the rest of the life of the planet. And therefore, we'll have time to figure out also how to expand off planet.
The scientific revolution starts now.
Let us see in the dark.
We interrupt this message to bring you another very important message.
This podcast, it's made possible because we're supported by patrons like you at Patreon, at Demystify Sci. Today on the show, we are talking about one of my favorite topics, which is intelligence. I have spent hundreds of hours talking with folks, trying to get to the bottom of what that word even means. And today we're actually talking about planetary intelligence. So we have Dr. David Grinspoon, an astrobiologist, on the show to speak about a recent paper that he collaborated with Sarah Walker and Adam Frank on discussing the modern, updated landscape of planetary intelligence as it stands. But first, I kind of wanted to ask you, David, how you got into all of this. Have you always, since you were a little kid, been interested in life in space? Or what's the road to somebody becoming, you know, interested in these topics? How did it work out for you? What was it like being a kid?
In some ways, I have the very kind of cliche story of space scientists of my generation. You know, one of my earliest memories was seeing the astronauts land on the moon, Apollo 11, when I was in the fourth grade. You know, it blew my young little mind and got me very excited about space. And, you know, I was a science fiction geek and a kind of space fan from an early age, and just followed the, you know, when I was a teenager, we had the first ever missions, spacecraft to Mars, and first ever spacecraft to Venus and to the outer solar system happening. And, you know, all these firsts, and it felt like the universe was sort of expanding in real time as far as our knowledge of it.
Were people pretty hopeful that there was going to be life found on those planets as they went out back then?
I think that kind of oscillated because, I mean, I was very steeped in science fiction. So, of course, I knew there would be life out there. But, you know, when the space age started, I think there was this general expectation that the planets would be more Earth-like than they really are. And that there may well be life. We thought maybe there was vegetation on Mars. It turned out it wasn't, you know, at least the markings that we thought were, and that Venus is a much more hostile place than we had thought to our kind of life. So there was a sort of initial rush of disappointment. And then our ideas about life maybe caught up with that when we realized, oh, life can exist in more extreme places than we thought. And we don't have to be so Earth-like, or Earth-focused in our geocentric in our ideas about life. So all that was happening. And I just knew I wanted to be a space scientist. And I had some, you know, sort of influential mentors when I was young that pushed me in that direction. And then that led me to planetary science. And I was definitely interested in what was called exobiology at the time, which was sort of a fringe of planetary science. The few scientists, Carl Sagan and others, who dared talk about life elsewhere, but it wasn't a central part of the field.
Why do you think there was so much resistance to that initially? Like, what is fundamentally unscientific about considering biology in a bigger context than locally?
I think a lot of it had to do, honestly, with NASA's sort of self-image and not
as like serious scientists.
Yes.
But what's unserious about it? That's what I'm trying
to
understand.
Speculative. Yeah. I think that scientists tend to shy away. We see this on the podcast all the time. You get somebody to start speculating about something that there isn't hard evidence for, and people get very uncomfortable very quickly.
Yeah. And you know, the origins of planetary science also was, there was this sense among astronomers, even, that planetary science wasn't respectable. that real astronomers studied the stars and galaxies. So I think there was maybe a little bit of a built-in insecurity in planetary science of like, well, we don't want to seem that far out. And then there was also, you know, in the 50s and 60s, there was like all the like UFO hype. And we're not those people. We're serious scientists. So the association with searching for extraterrestrial life had associations that scientists didn't see as part of their self-image, and that changed later on. But that's definitely how I got into it. And then, you know, as far as intelligence, there's SETI, the question of a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which was always a draw for me. And then all these sort of science fiction ideas. But I was more generally just a science geek. So, you know, when you start learning about evolution, you start really getting into this question of what is it about humans that is so different, and is it really so different? And how do you define what that is? And somehow, the word intelligence, you know, whatever that is,
we'll get to that
in those discussions.
Yeah, there does seem to be something at least extreme about the way humans are in relation to all the other life forms, which does sort of circle around this idea of intelligence to some extent. And I think that it has to do with the ability to abstractly consider things, to make new concepts, you know, especially when in the context of artificial intelligence. It's like, at some point, the little bots have to come up with their own ideas in order to really be intelligent. Is that what you guys, from what I understand, I mean, this is a loaded question. It doesn't seem like that's exactly what you guys mean in your paper when you're talking about planetary scale intelligence.
Well, I mean, first of all, I agree with you. I think abstraction is a real key to what distinguishes human intelligence from other kinds of intelligence. But I guess it depends on how broadly we want to use the word, because I wouldn't say that other animals, you know, and maybe even plants, we can get into that, but certainly other life forms that have some degree of what we would call intelligence, you know, the ability to, you know, having cognitive systems and solving problems and behaving in response to stimuli. You know, there's a lot of things we can talk about. You know, my dog Jasper, I think has intelligence, but I don't think he does a lot of abstracting. I think
so. It's more like attention or something. Would you say it's like closer to attention, or, you know, the ability to.
I have this feeling that it has something to do with goal-oriented problem solving in this way. Where so it's like something that I saw the other day is that there was a chart of heartbeat versus life expectancy, and if you look, animals from whales to hamsters to tigers to mice—they're all on this neat curve. Where as your heart rate decreases, your lifespan increases. And then way off in the corner, there's humans. And to me, that's a sign of the fact that humans have decided that we want to live for longer, and we are going to figure out how to change biology in such a way that we will escape these natural limitations that other organisms have.
Yeah, I wonder if you, on that chart, if you put in the life expectancy of humans,
like 300 years ago or 500 years ago,
or even I was going to say 100,000 years ago, but when we were more or less anatomically the same, but before we had, become technologically, our lifespans had become technologically enhanced for all kinds of reasons, the way they are now, probably
from like
years, you're right, would do it, but that'd be interesting. But yeah, we've made ourselves outliers in some interesting ways for sure.
And that's kind of what you mean by planetary intelligence, though, is like the ability for the planet to sustain itself almost in this, like,
is it a technological
intentional
thing?
Way? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good question. So we, you know, so I first came across this term. I started using the term planetary intelligence when I was working on a book that I wrote called Earth in Human Hands. And the point of that book was to look at the Anthropocene, the phase of human influenced geological evolution that we're apparently in now, in the context of long-term planetary evolution, and try to, from an astrobiological perspective, say what's different about us, what's different about now. And the thing that I really kept coming back to, the aspect of our existence, is that it's not that we're just another geological force. We're the first geological force aware of its own existence. And that creates the possibility for some kind of feedback where that awareness can actually guide our behavior in a way that wasn't possible before we had that awareness. And that's when I first started using the phrase planetary intelligence. So I meant something specific by it there. And then when I did that paper with Adam and Sarah, I think we expanded out on it a little bit to talking about different phases. There's a kind of planetary intelligence we talked about that was probably here long before humans were here. And then you get into like the Gaia picture of Earth, where if there are feedback loops sort of acting in response to information and tweaking the behavior of the system in certain ways so as to maintain some kind of desirable state, you can look at that as some kind of a intelligence, some kind of a cognitive system, the way an individual organism that doesn't abstract the way we do, but maybe has some, you know, sort of nervous system where it takes in information and makes decisions to be able to survive. And that, you know, that's a level of intelligence. And we realized that there were behaviors of the planet with life, but before humans and technology, that had some characteristics in common with an organism with a basic intelligent behavior. So we talked about that as a certain level. And then the interesting question is, what does it mean for planetary intelligence when you have humans and globally influential technology? And even with that, we decided there were multiple levels. There's the level of sort of inadvertent changes that we've mostly been in, where you have these clever creatures doing things to the planet, but not really aware of what they're doing to the planet. But then if you develop that awareness and the global activities start reflecting that awareness, then you've got a more sophisticated kind of intelligence and a different mode of behavior. And that's the kind of planetary intelligence that we, certainly in my book, and I think a little bit in our paper, we imply that, you know, it would be a healthy thing to seek, because that's where you get the sort of feedbacks on your behavior that leads to potentially more longevity and less of a sort of self-destructive kind of mode. So,
and it would make sense that would take a significant amount of time and iteration, because I have a tendency to look at things as being reflected in each other at scale. And so I feel like the evolution of intelligence on the planet is similar to the evolution of intelligence in an organism, where when you're young, you make a lot of stupid decisions and you have no idea what you're doing. And then as you get older, you start to understand how things fit together, and then you're able to make better decisions. And I feel like planetary intelligence is in its adolescence right now.
Yeah, no, exactly.
If not infancy.
That's a really good point. And that's what you just said is, I think, very similar to the way we look at it, because I mentioned those different levels, and I didn't say the word right now, but in our paper and in my book, we talk about mature versus immature planetary intelligence. And there is an analogy even with a maturing individual. You could say that you have sort of what are the hallmarks of adolescent intelligence? Well, you don't necessarily think through the consequences of your actions. You know, that's the cliche, you know, clean up your room, you know, the connection of cause and effect is not really there. It's more less situational awareness, more seeking immediate returns, immediate gratification. And the sort of more mature level is there's an awareness of consequence, and that is sort of folded into action. And so I think the metaphor of childhood and adolescence and then maturity is a good one for these potentially different mechanisms and levels of planetary intelligence.
So then does that mean that the planet as a whole struggles with the same sort of crisis of meaning that people struggle with, of, you know, what is the point?
Well, it's a great question. You know, the planet as a whole, it's tricky when you start talking about these things, because I think there are planetary scale problems that require planetary scale solutions and ways that we can look at planetary scale mechanisms. But of course, humanity is complicated, and not everybody's the same, and we're not all doing and thinking the same thing. And some places are more privileged, and some, you know, it's like, it's when you actually look on the ground and say, you know, you start saying we are this and we do that, and then you could say, well, wait a minute, who's we? Who do you mean? You know, do you mean like rich white Americans, or do you mean we, all of humanity? And then, you know, so I can't help but responding that way to your question, because when we talk about sort of the whole planet aspiring to something or having a thought, I mean, I'm very drawn to that whole planet idea of cognition. And I think there's a level at which it's true, but there's also levels at which the, you know, the reality, the granular reality is a messy thing. Of course, you could say that about...
It's interesting if you look at neurons too. Okay, yeah, you're going to say the same thing. Yeah, exactly.
We're jinx.
Yeah, right. It's like you have to sum the signals, right? So each neuron's getting lots of different voices in its ear, and it has to make a decision at some point. And it's...
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So it may be like I'm saying, oh, the reality is messy and granular, but if you could suddenly dive into a brain... And look around you and go, oh, is this a coherent thing?
Nobody agrees on anything.
Yeah, exactly. It's noisy and fractious, you know. So maybe it is similar in that way. And then out of that arises some sort of consensus thought, right? And so maybe globally that is what's happening, but it's hard for us to see it being neurons.
Well, there is the idea of the zeitgeist too, because I think that's like the
Overton window.
The Overton window is a little bit different. I'm thinking more of Newton and Leibniz discovering calculus at the same time, where I'm like, that to me is the output of this level of general intelligence where everybody has agreed that these are the things that we're thinking about, this is what we're talking about, and this is the way to solve the problem. And so people stumble onto the next level.
There are ideas that are sort of in the air, or that make sense to, there are thoughts that make sense to have now, given what has been thought and said recently, and that anybody could have them, or collectively we may have them. And so, yeah, I think you're right. What seems like an individual occurrence to us, because we can't help having that mind frame, looked at a different scale, may be some kind of a more collective process.
Mm-hmm.
So would that make the human beings the something like the sense organ of this hypothetical organism?
Something like that, but you could also say that, you know, I have this picture of in the last 50 years, we've been surrounding the planet with all of these satellites, many of which are, some of which are looking out, but many of which are looking back in, and we're doing this, we've sort of evolved this new organ. Planet Earth has evolved this new sensory organ, which is like this, almost like a mycelium of connected satellites that are radioing signals and sensing what's happening on the planet. And then ideally, those sensory inputs are alerting us to problems and changes that we should be aware of, and acting like the sort of self-sensing organ that allows us to more intelligently sort of handle our own presence here on the planet.
And they're reaching out too, which is quite interesting, because it's hard to imagine an organism existing in isolation. Like you don't usually define a species by one organism, right? It would be like you generally have communities. So if the Earth is to be treated as an organism, we should almost definitely expect other organisms to be of its same family to be out there and obviously interested in one another as life forms.
If you look at a neuron in a dish, that's exactly what happens. If you have a single neuron, you can watch as it sends out its pseudopods, and they look like little hands, and they're basically looking around to see who they can connect with and how they can start to form this network.
Absolutely. And we have certainly been, again, in the last 50, 60, 70 years, sending out little bits of Earth with sensors to the rest of the solar system, and kind of exploring our surroundings, sending out pseudopods, if you like, to the neighboring worlds. So there is some analogy there. I mean, I think you got to be a little bit careful with argument by analogy. I mean, it's interesting and you can gain insights from it for sure, but it's also sort of, it's a weak form of argument to say, therefore it must be
sure
like this because it's kind of like this other thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. There's exceptions all over the place. You have to be careful.
Yeah. It's certainly a good source of insight because it can help sort of change your frame, which we need a lot of that.
And NASA and all the space explorers in general are looking for life actively.
But they don't have a DNA sequencing machine on the new rover, which I don't understand.
That's a good question. Are we really looking for life? Astrobiology has I mentioned, you know, exobiology was sort of a fringe thing when planetary science was new in the 60s, 70s, really 80s. And then starting in the 1990s, astrobiology became a thing because we discovered several sort of promising, there were several discoveries made in the late 1990s, which collectively sort of changed our attitude about the possibility of life elsewhere. And so astrobiology went from being a fringe to being kind of central to NASA's mission. And now it's very much what we talk about. But you're right, we don't really have life sensors on our spacecraft. We talk a lot about characterizing conditions to look for habitability and understand the history of habitability. And, you know, there's different opinions about that. Some people think that's smart because we don't really know how to build a life sensor yet without really assuming too much about what we're looking for. Some people say that was the problem with Viking, which was our one life-seeking mission, that we didn't really know what we were doing. It was laden with assumptions.
Well, we don't have a definition for life yet, which is a bit annoying. So that's true.
That's true. But other people think, well, we're just chickening out and we really should send life sensors. I think there's some validity to both points of view, but absolutely we can't define life. And, you know, really, we probably won't be able to find life until won't be able to define life until we find life and understand really what it has in common on more than one world. And that's sort of an interesting paradox. How can you search for something that you can't define, but how can you define something that you haven't found yet? So
I think that people are actually genuinely shocked if you look at the history of astronomy that they don't find, like, everybody expected there to be life on all of the other planets, from what I can tell, at least as they were discovered. You know, they had different even hypotheses about what their cultures would be like. I think who was it, some guy was looking at originally looking at Jupiter and figured that since it had so many oceans that their continents must be full of hemp because they needed to grow sail, or they needed to grow the hemp to make sails for all of the rigging that they would need. So
there's a lot of literature like that where people deduced, you know, the people on Mars must be tall because gravity's lower, and there's a whole lot of that. And, you know, when we first discovered that the other planets were planets and not just moving lights in the sky, we didn't know anything about them other than the fact that they were worlds like Earth, and they were suddenly in the same category as our own planet. And since we didn't know anything else about them, it was natural to impart Earth-like qualities and creatures to them. And so that was sort of the assumption, you know, before really even we had telescopes to, good telescopes to understand what the planets were like. And then when we first had telescopic images, we interpreted things as sort of life hopeful. We saw markings on Mars and we said those are canals, or we saw seasonal changes. We said that's vegetation.
Until fairly recently, right? This is up until the 70s or something. Yeah.
Right up until we started sending spacecraft there, there were people that still said there's probably vegetation. And then those first spacecraft pictures and measurements were very disappointing.
Yeah, that must have been heartbreaking. I can just imagine people just slamming their heads on the desk like this. Oh, yeah. Geez.
In fact, if you look at the... I've done some of this. If you look at the newspaper coverage from, you know, the first mission to Venus, which showed that, oh, no, there's no oceans there. It's really hot. It was Mariner 2 in 1961. And the New York Times, with the way they reported this, they said, Venus says no. This marks the This marks the beginning of the end of mankind's grand romantic dreams. That's literally what they said. And something similar when Mariner 4 first went by Mars and they saw that it was cratered and looked like the moon and wasn't, you know, this sort of Lowellian paradise. Similarly, the newspapers said, you know, this is horrible. This is a disappointment. So
I think that it does make sense, though, because there's a moment where you of potential where you look out at the solar system and you believe that you aren't alone. And then all of a sudden you look closer and I can like hear the sound of the wind, you know, the solar wind in space and just the like the dramatic Hans Zimmer chord of you are alone. And that's a horrible realization. So I understand the drama.
Or your neighbors are really far away, you know, which is equally depressing, perhaps.
I mean, but there was something, you know, sort of naively comforting about the idea that there might be similar places. You know, it's like a kind of heaven, you know, C.S. Lewis stories on the other nearby planets. And then, it was disappointment that it wasn't like that.
But fact that there's a frontier, right? Like, I know that it's hard to talk about the frontier without talking about colonialism and extraction and abuse and slavery and everything else. But I think that we are in a weird place psychologically because for the very first time, there is nowhere to explore in a way where you can just get on a horse and go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I that is the history of our species. I mean, you know, you don't have to talk about colonial era, which we do sort of unfortunately associate with the notion of a frontier, but you go back further, you know, and there was a time when all humans were in Africa and then we started spreading around the planet. And that's sort of our history is to go live in new places and figure out how to live in new places. And we're not really doing that now. And
I wonder if the free-floating anxiety of our time is not partially due to that, where it's like we hoped that perhaps these planets would be a place where we could go and we could continue building the dream of humans as an interplanetary species. And now you look at it and you're like, well, going there would be the equivalent of going to hell. And it's like, I suppose we could go there, but...
It's an interesting idea. I mean, certainly, you know, there was this sense of optimism in the early exploration of the solar system that, you know, that I was describing as a youth, I was very caught up in. And the idea was in the future was part of this utopian vision where not only would we be, there'd be humans living, you know, I thought 2001 was realistic when it came out and I was a kid, you know, we not only would be, we'd be off at Jupiter and other places, but we would also be cooperating with, you know, our geopolitical enemies and we'd be, you know, there'd be, it was part of this idea that humanity would progress to this in this more unified way. And not only did the planets turn out to be more alien than we imagined, but like we're certainly going through a time right now when humanity does not seem to be uniting in a way that's going to make it easy to solve our global problems. So, you know, I guess there are many possible sources for that freeform anxiety you described, but certainly the solar system is not, you know, as welcoming as some of us had perhaps naively fantasized.
Yeah. And so where does that leave us, right? Because we do have these programs to go and to settle, but it seems like they are inherently going to be on the scale of colonial projects rather than on the scale of the individual groups of humans deciding that they're going to go out. Because I can't imagine anything beyond a state level or, you know, wealthiest person on Earth level project that starts a colony on a different planet.
Yeah, even with that, it's not going to be something that's a significant movement of human beings for quite some time. By the way, I've personally stopped using the word colony and colonialization when I talk about space. And I understand there are uses of that word that are completely benign. Like you can talk about, organisms in a Petri dish colonizing the next Petri dish over. It's a biological.
It's a microbiologist.
But because people have these associations with it and it's fraught, rather than have that conversation every time and put in that disclaimer, I've just found that it's easier to say use other words. So I,
what words use? I would love, because I'm like settling, colonialism, frontier.
Yeah, I mean, I started using settling because I think that's much better. And then, of course, people come back and say,
as somebody who's Jewish, I'm like,
settler colonialism. But, you know, but it's like that to me, that's a weaker association. It's like you could almost any word you can find some negative association. But then, but actually, because of that, I often say inhabiting, like when we inhabit Mars or inhabit, you know, or even like the peopling of space, you know. So there are workarounds. Those are the workarounds I use.
Let's talk a little bit about what are the habitable planets and how freaking far away are these things? Like, is this...
And these are theoretically habitable planets the same way that
are
Mars...
Are there any even? Yeah, I don't know a ton about this. I'm just curious.
Well, okay, so it depends on what we mean by habitable. Sorry to go back to that. But, you know, because people talk about Earth 2.0. I don't believe there is an Earth 2.0. In
That's
other words,
not good.
There will be... Well, it depends on, you know, I don't think it's necessarily bad. I just mean... I don't mean there's no other places that humans could ever go and live, but I don't think there's another planet that's going to be so similar to Earth that it's going to be sort of like a Star Trek world where we can say, oh, it's a breathable atmosphere, Captain, and sort of beam down and say, oh, the fruit tastes pretty good. You know, it's kind of sweet, because evolution is so random. And the more we learn about planets, the more we learn that in a way, planets are more like people than they are like protons. In other words, protons, no two are different. They're all the same, but people, no two are alike. And I think,
but they are of a species like though. Are they not? Are the yes. people are yes. of a species, right?
So oh, absolutely.
You no, could there more.
All
yeah.
people, there are things that all people have in common. And there's some people that are very much alike, like identical twins. And there will be planets that are more alike than others. But I'm just saying,
are we finding any of those?
Well, we're at the beginning of finding exoplanets, which sounds funny because you say, oh, we found 5,000. But, you know, there are literally, we know billions in our galaxy alone. And we're just starting to get a good look at them. And the ones we've been able to see best, the ones we've been able to find, it's very biased towards non-Earth-like ones. Because they're bigger and they have smaller orbits, which, you know, they torque around their stars more and they block more light. So we're just really getting to the point now where we're building up the demographics of more Earth-like planets to understand that question. And it's clear that there are planets that are rocky and roughly Earth-sized in the, you know, the habitable zones of their stellar systems, meaning in a zone where you could have liquid water on the surface. So in that sense, there will be Earth 2.0s. But in the sense of an atmosphere that's evolved to, you know, 80% nitrogen and 20% oxygen, and, all these things that are dependent, that we are dependent on environmental qualities, I'm skeptical that there'll be planets that are that similar.
That kind of makes sense too. I don't know about in existence that there are none, but, you know, it seems like it's a particular moment in our own planet's history that it's just like this, that the atmosphere is perfectly just like this. And so if you think about all of the planets having these lifetimes, I don't know a better word to use, but if they have this whole evolutionary, you know, journey,
yeah,
then you're looking for a tiny little moment in a planet's life, it seems like.
No, absolutely. In fact, some of my colleagues have this saying, the ancient Earth is an exoplanet. In other words, there hasn't just been one Earth. If you were an alien that had come here a billion years ago, you would have seen a really different atmosphere. And if you had come 3 billion years ago, you would have seen a really different atmosphere with no free oxygen. And it's life itself that has made Earth's atmosphere and other qualities of the planet so weird in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, Earth has been changing, and the details we're not going to find on another planet exactly
unless,
the same way.
Unless there's some kind of convergent evolution, right? Because, what you said something really interesting, which is that if you come back 3 billion years ago, it's a totally different planet, and life on the planet has shaped through biogeochemical cycles the atmospheric composition that is amenable to life. And so we talk about this all the time. It seems entirely possible that the window of possibilities for life and structures are bounded by physics and chemistry, right? They're bounded by these foundational principles. And so if you could go somewhere else and find a planet with life, it would have to look like us. Like, there would be an octopus, there would be a human, there would be a, you know, there would be a monkey, a dolphin, a hamster, a porcupine, whatever, on that other planet, because that is just the limitation of what it means for life to go through its program.
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, what are the limits of convergence? I mean, you know, Stephen Jay Gould famously said that if you could play the tape of life on Earth over again, you wouldn't have the same biosphere. And I believe that. I think Stephen Jay Gould's metaphor of the tape is a lousy one, because a tape is a recording. It plays back the same every time. But if you could start the process over again and with all the randomness, it's more like a pachinko game, something with like things falling in random places. But there's so much contingency. I think there are niches. You would have something like an octopus. Maybe you'd have recognizable forms, but I doubt it's an interesting question. And there are obviously there are differences of opinion. There's a range of opinion on this amongst evolutionary biologists. So this is one of the questions when we come back to intelligence: is that a convergent property that, you know, just makes sense to evolve? But I think you're right, by the way, that there could be some degree of convergent evolution of planetary biospheres. I actually wrote an essay about this where I started off saying we're not going to live in a Star Trek universe for the reasons I gave. And then I ended up coming around the end and saying, well, maybe it would be, because I convinced myself, okay, if you had oxygen-based life, if you had photosynthesis, you'd start pumping oxygen into the atmosphere. But why do we have 20% oxygen? Well, supposedly that has to do with the combustion limit of forests. If you had more than that, you'd have spontaneous combustion. So that convinced me, okay, so you might have other planets for those reasons that have something like 20% oxygen. So that, you know, that there may be surprisingly Earth-like planets out there. I would concede that.
it totally gels with the idea that an organism doesn't exist in isolation. A species doesn't exist. And if Earth is an organism, then it should have brother and sister organisms, whatever, mother and daughter organisms, whatever you
want
to call
it. It should have a family tree that it sits somewhere on.
Yeah, you would think so.
And no, I agree with that. My fantasy for, the people that I'm jealous of in my profession are the astrobiologists of the future, hundreds of years from now, when we have, 20 or 100 examples of inhabited planets, and we can categorize them and put them in some kind of a family tree. Or, in astronomy, we have this thing called the HR diagram, the Hertzberg-Russell diagram, which has the life histories of stars. And we have the old cool red ones over here and the hot young blue ones over here. And that, we categorize them. And my fantasy is that, yeah, someday with planets and even with inhabited planets, we'll have that chart of, here are the different types. And here are the ones that are kind of like Earth and the 20% oxygen ones. And here are the methane rich ones or whatever. There ought to be a family tree, but right now we can't populate it with anything like knowledge, only with speculation and modeling and fantasy.
I think it's worth remembering always that, as far as I understand it, we didn't think that anything existed outside the galaxy until the 1920s. So we're at 100 years of having a universe that expands beyond the Milky Way. And so we're still so early in the process of understanding all of this. And as you're born into the knowledge, it seems like it's knowledge that humans have held for forever. And there's something very finite and solved feeling about astrophysics and astronomy in general, because these are objects that are in the sky for extended periods of time. There is this very settled story of how they got there, of how they're formed, of how they persist, of how they will die. People write all these books about what the end of the universe will look like. And so you go through it and you're like, oh, well, I guess it's all figured out. But just like any science, we're kind of at this edge where new discoveries will force us to rewrite things. And it's going to be really interesting to see, like you said, 100 years from now, how are the foundational stories, even down to the Big Bang? What will these stories look like 100 years from now? Because there are, I don't think that we operate with any theories that are 100 years old for anything.
No, and there's a persistent phenomenon in in science where we always think that what we know now is we've basically got it figured out and it's just down to the details. And, you know, they thought that 100 years ago.
And 10,000 years before that.
Well, yeah, kind of. But I mean, even so science is not 1,000 years old, but certainly worldviews.
Cosmic explanations. Exactly.
We're pretty secure in their worldviews. But
the Earth was born from the darkness by the goddess who carried the light. Like, it was just like, well, yeah, obviously that's how this happened. And everybody was just like,
But certainly contemporary science, I mean, we think like, yeah, well, we got to work out some things, but we basically got it. But then, you know, I read books. I'm not a cosmologist. I'm a planetary scientist. But I read books about the Big Bang or the end of the universe or dark matter, dark energy. And I go like, really? You think that? Well, yeah, I can see how that fits the evidence you have, but I'm not convinced you've really got it worked out and that 100 years from now we'll think all that. And certainly in my own field, I know that it's in its infancy. I mean, it's just exoplanets. When I was in grad school, we were taught there ought to be planets around other stars because everything we know about the sun tells us it's a normal star. And our understanding of the way the planets formed was sort of a natural byproduct of star formation. So there are those other stars. They should have planets, but we don't have any way to observe them. And now, of course, once we develop that observing capability, you know, boop, 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 they start popping out and we see, oh, we live in a galaxy full of exoplanets. So our speculation turned out to be absolutely right.
It's a lot more of an important part of science than people want to admit, really, is the imaginative, creative, hypothesis-generating stage. I mean, when I was in grad school, one of the things I witnessed, and I had a great lab and a great mentor and everything, but a lot of students had very little time to be creative and play with ideas that really you don't have any evidence for yet. That's your job, is to go out and see what's up. And I wonder why scientists are so afraid of playing in the sandbox of ideas.
You can't really make money off of the sandbox of ideas. Like, you can't submit a grant to the NIH.
But you need to play to have ideas to send off to the NIH.
And this is something that we circle around all the time, right? It's like how we're. I feel like the process of training scientists is more and more settling into a process of work, right? You see grad students unionizing at universities. Why are they unionizing? Mm-hmm. Well, they're unionizing because they're being used as workers. They're not being used as people who come and they're allowed to play and explore. And this was a fantasy that I had when I went to grad school, where I was like, you know, I work in a laboratory as a tech, but I'm going to go to grad school and it's going to be a place where I can sit and ponder the mysteries of the universe. And that was not what grad school was for. Grad school was basically this high throughput process of becoming somebody who could do bench work, write papers, and get grants. And then it felt like a pyramid scheme on some level.
Yeah, honestly, I know what you're saying, and I see that all over the place. And I feel like I was kind of lucky in that I was getting in on a new field.
Mm-hmm,
Planetary science was a new field. It still is, but when I... Well, first of all, this is,
and I think that was Shiloh's experience too. So I think that, like, you know, two anecdotes are now we're starting to edge on data.
I mean, here's a weird fact about me. I think I have the first ever undergraduate degree in planetary science, as far as I know, because when I was an undergraduate, I applied for and got permission to make up my own major, which didn't That's exist, amazing. Which I called planetary science. And then I went to grad school in University of Arizona in the planetary science department, which was fairly new. And I learned that none of my professors there themselves had a degree in planetary science. They had a degree in geology or chemistry or physics or astronomy, because planetary science did not exist when they were in grad school. So there's sort of a first and second generation thing. And I think maybe because of that, I didn't have the feeling of being so much of it, because there wasn't sort of a factory yet. You know?
Yeah, I was in a microbiology laboratory. I mean, like, it's a factory. It's just like there's a protein and there's a molecule and you're going to figure out how they interact and then you're going to write a paper about that. And then you're going to turn to a different molecule and figure out how they interact. And it's just kind of like,
But I think a flip side of that being a new field is this kind of insecurity we talked about before. Where you don't want to seem too speculative because you're trying to become respectable. And so
because then you're Graham Hancock.
You don't talk about aliens as much. So, you know, but there's been a progression. So like I said, in grad school, they talk about exoplanets as this thing that we ought to be able to find someday. And they believe they existed, but they didn't have any actual observational evidence. And what's interesting is that right now I would put life, extraterrestrial life, in that same category, where there's a lot of reasoned speculation, a lot of good arguments as to why it ought to exist by analogy with what's happened here and by the fact that we can't find anything unusual really about Earth that should prevent it from, you know, should make it so distinct. And yet we haven't observed it yet. So the question is, can just like we made that leap with exoplanets from speculation to observation, and once we learned how to observe it, it turned out the universe is full of them. Can we do that with extraterrestrial life? We have these speculations. We have ideas about how to observe it. Can we start to find it? And once we do, maybe we'll find it everywhere.
That seems like that's inherently part of what people call the scientific method, though, is this. I mean, how can you, it must be part of the hypothesis. The speculation must be part of the hypothesis. I don't know how, what else it would be.
I think that it's the degree of speculation that we should learn to be comfortable with, because I feel like very often inside of established fields, the degree of speculation is very, very narrow. And you have this window of what you're allowed to say. And I think that this was something that Lynn Margulis came across when she was working on the endosymbiont hypothesis. It was, or Lovelock was working on the Gaia hypothesis. It's like these weren't things that you say because they were so far beyond what could be evident, proven with evidence. Mm. And science is right. Fundamentally...
You want to have something testable. And in order for it to be science, you know, we think of it, you have to be able to make a prediction, do an experiment, verify or refute the idea. And that's, you know, there's some ideas that are really good ideas, but hard to test. And I would put Gaia in that, mm-hmm. in that category. It's clearly a good idea. And it's changed the way we think about evolution and life. And it's important. But what one experiment can you propose that's going to say, well, if this, you know, it's either going to confirm or refute the Gaia hypothesis. I mean, once I'm my future astrobiologists with 100 planets to talk about and categorize, then I think I'll have the evidence for that.
But yeah, I think the test would be, are there others, really? That right. Seems like a reasonable test to offer. It's like
that's the best test. I mean, people have talked about, you know, different kind of re-examining Earth history and stability and homeostasis and all that, but it's hard to really be predictive about it without other examples.
Yeah, I mean, we had this conversation. We had Gavin Schmidt on the show where we were talking about the Silurian hypothesis, and we brought the Gaia hypothesis into the conversation, and he kind of got upset about it. He was like, "This isn't a fruitful, productive way to be thinking because there's nothing that can be done in terms of moving science forward. It's a philosophical argument that people are just going to get lost in," and I understand where he's coming from on some level, right? Because he's coming...
I understand where he's coming from. And Gavin's a friend of mine. I like him a lot, and I think he's really smart. But I disagree with him about the value of Gaia. And I do agree, it's in a way, it's more of a philosophical idea than a scientific idea. Or I would describe it as an idea of natural philosophy, which is sort mm-hmm. of right on the boundary between the two. And it's challenging if you think of it as just as a scientific idea that's worthless if I can't test it. And maybe that's a little bit where Gavin's coming from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could see where that would be frustrating. But if it's...
It doesn't seem technological. It doesn't seem like technological. I don't know what the word is.
That's a good word, yeah.
It doesn't seem like he can immediately, like, technologize it in a way. I think that's what he was upset about. He's like, it's a useless idea or something like that, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's like... People, there have been a lot of problems with the way Gaia has been discussed, and it's been a sort of squishy concept that people mean different things when they describe it. And there's a lot of scientists that have become sort of impatient with discussions of Gaia, which I think is too bad, because I think at its core, there's some really important problems that even if you, some really important ideas in Gaia that even if you can't test it with one prediction in the absence of 100 inhabited planets, which we'll be able to do someday, I think it can guide the way we think about life and even guide the way we do science. And I think that it's very important for the way we think about extraterrestrial life. And in that sense, it can be used in a practical way when we're building space telescopes and experiments. I think that if we don't think of life as something that changes planets, if we just think of planets as environments where there could be life, and not environments that are made by life and changed by life, then we're going to be thinking of inhabited planets the wrong way. And that's a way in which the Gaia hypothesis, in its deepest meaning, absolutely is essential for astrobiology. And whether people realize it or not, all these people searching for atmospheric biosignatures and signs of disequilibrium, they are applying Gaia theory to astrobiology, whether they are aware that, and whether they call it that or not.
How much do you stay abreast of the news from SETI? We just had Avi Loeb on the show the other day, and he's absolutely convinced that the best way to look for life is to imagine that life is intelligent like us, and that we should basically be looking for really better versions of ourselves out there, as opposed to looking for these molecular traces and things like that. Do you, what's your position?
Well, I think it's silly to make a definitive statement about that. I think that we ought to explore broadly, because we have no idea what's out there. And you can have an opinion about that, but it's not an informed opinion. You know, there are people that believe that we ought to just be looking for microbes, because the chance of so-called intelligence is so slim compared to that. And then there are other people with the opposite opinion. And the honest answer is that we just don't know, that it makes sense to, if we can look for microbes, if we can look for atmospheric traces of microbial biospheres, we should. And there is an argument that some fraction of life in the universe will have gained technological intelligence and therefore made itself much more visible. That's really what Avi's saying. I think it's a decent argument. And I think it would be foolish of us not to look for that kind of life also. But I don't think you need to build up one at the expense of the other, given our ignorance. It's certainly true that you know, by the same kinds of arguments that you believe there's life elsewhere because there's nothing unusual about Earth that made life, there's really nothing we know that prevents the evolution of technological intelligence from happening elsewhere. And that could indeed transform planets observationally in ways that are very profound. I would disagree if Avi really said we should look for intelligence that's like us, because I think we're probably very, very young as an intelligence. In other words, if there are multiple examples, if the universe is full of technological intelligent life, then it's going to be a very rare thing to find anyone as young as we are, since we're so young as a technological species. So almost all of them will be more, you know, going back to the word, mature. And that's probably a good thing, because if, you know, they'll have had powerful planet changing technology long enough so that they'll either have learned to live with it, which is something we need to do, or they won't be around anymore. So I actually think that it's more likely that we'll find creatures that are like what we want to become than like what we are now in our sort of unstable configuration, where we're just trying to figure out, you know, can we do this planetary civilization thing with our technology?
Mm. What's really interesting is he's speaking to physicists and astronomers, which, by the way, it's kind of interesting that astronomers and physicists are often the same group of people. And I think he's sort of being like, guys, maybe a lot of the stuff you're seeing is biological in nature. I mean, he doesn't say it like that, but I think that's essentially what he's saying. Like, what if we start examining these anomalous processes that we observe in the sky as not fundamentally physical processes, but biophysical processes?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly something that we ought to think about. You know, there's a bias, and we should think through whether it's a correct one, that biology is the explanation of last resort. Mm. You know, there is sort of the Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, that if you just can't understand something, and you go, aha, it's aliens, you're like the guy with the funny hair, you know? And it's a little bit like the whole sort of ancient astronauts thing. It's like, oh, they couldn't possibly have built the pyramids, you know, it must be aliens, you know, just because something is mysterious to us doesn't mean you have to invoke aliens. So that's the argument against it. Nonetheless, I think there's
But you can't rule it out too by the same logic. It's just like,
absolutely. Yeah. And we do tend to rule it out. Our scientists do tend to rule it out. And I think in that sense, Avi is absolutely right that we need to be open to biological hypotheses and treat them, you know, not as these sort of just like completely freak, you know, extremely improbable.
Just don't treat them as unscientific. Yeah.
But treat that, you know, say, okay, so if that's your hypothesis, then what else would you observe? You know, like try to test it.
So if life on Earth is representative of a planetary organism, a la the Gaia hypothesis, then the organism will one day die, because that's what organisms do. Nothing is immortal. And if that organism, and I can imagine many different ways for that to happen, right? Like the Earth, we definitely know, is changing. It's losing its atmosphere. The sun will at some point expand and swallow Earth. We might fight ourselves to death. That seems to me to imply a necessity to leave the planet and to go forward, because even if we were to die and to not do that, I imagine that there would be a spreading of seed through the universe by way of panspermia. Bacterial spores can survive in space just fine. It's probably already happening. So, because there's spore-forming bacteria in the atmosphere, and so I can imagine them easily being blown away. We're not looking, but I imagine that we'll find it when it's there. Does that suggest that there is a huge imperative to have humans leave the planet? Because if bacteria are the only ones that leave the planet, they leave the planet without the accumulated library of wisdom. That
sense organ.
Without the, it's not even necessarily the sense organ. I think that humans are the scribes. They're the ones that write it down, and they have a language for being able to talk
like
about
the self-aware,
things.
The self-aware thing that we were talking about before.
I mean, I didn't get to say that I kind of disagreed with it at the time, because I think that everybody is a sense organ. Humans are the catalogers. We're the scribes. We're the note takers.
Self-awareness, or the bacteria, like, I'm a bacteria.
I think they are. I don't know. I know that's stupid, but I think maybe they are. But
yeah,
I guess
I hear what you're saying. You know, yes, Gaia. At least if you define Gaia as a biosphere on Earth, it will die someday. If you allow for the fact that maybe it'll reproduce and bits of it'll go move off somewhere and live on, and that way maybe it won't have to die. I guess it depends on how you're defining, you know, the unit of Gaia. But, you know,
By that definition, none of us have ever died, I guess, since there's a continuous cell going all the way back.
That's right. But I think that if you identify with Gaia as opposed to identifying with an individual species or an individual self, human self, then there is a sense in which we do have a kind of immortality that we've been you and I, as part of Gaia, have been here for 4 billion years or so. You know, from that perspective, yeah, it would be, I think.
Yeah, maybe she even came from somewhere else before that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I think there is kind of an imperative to keep going and to survive. I think that's a very basic drive that life has. And so, yeah, I think that, I mean, we've got plenty of time before these things happen, like the sun, you know, evolving to the point where it makes life on Earth impossible, or the atmosphere evolving in some irreversible way. You know, none of those are immediate threats to the biosphere. You know, an asteroid impact is a more immediate threat, but we're almost already at the point where we could see it coming and bat it out of the way. So our real immediate threats are self-induced. And I'm not a fan of sort of running off to other planets, running away from our self-induced problems. So I feel like, you know, as Carl Sagan said, Earth is where we make our stand. But I think that's true about we as contemporary humans. But as, you know, as agents of the biosphere in the long run, I do think that there's every reason to believe that we'll want to go out and start self-sustaining inhabitants elsewhere. And I think that it's likely that if we get through this sort of technological bottleneck we're in now and really make it through the next century or two and develop a sort of more mature, healthy relationship with our, you know, with our planet and our technological presence, learn how to kind of integrate the two in a healthy way, then I think we're going to be around for a long time, maybe even sort of the rest of the life of the planet. And therefore, we'll have time to figure out also how to expand off planet. I see it more on that kind of evolutionary timescale than something that we're going to, I mean, I know there are people that have plans to try to build self-sustaining cities on Mars in the next decade or two, and good luck to them. But I think that I see it as a longer term process that will sort of for real become a more mature species on Earth and then start to kind of move out and inhabit the rest of the universe.
Right on.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic place to stop, to leave.
You're a busy man. We gotta let you go. But where can folks find out more about your work? What's in the pipes for you? Are you working on a new book or anything cool you want to share with people? Or?
Yeah, I have a couple of books that are in the works, but nothing that's sort of ready for prime time.
All right.
I'm part of the Da Vinci mission to Venus, which you can go online and find out about. You can follow me, at least as of today. I'm still on Twitter, and that's I'm at Dr. Funky Spoon, Dr. Funky Spoon. I've got a website, which is funkyscience.net. And certainly you can check out Earth in Human Hands, which is my book that explores actually a lot of what we've been talking about today, different aspects of that. So that might be a good place to start.
Awesome. Folks, we will put those links in the description. And David, again, thank you so much. It's been really cool to talk to you. Hopefully we can catch up down the road a little bit.
I hope so. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Great. Thank you so much.
See you.
Take care. Bye-bye.